All right. I have good news for all of you parents as well. Actually, for everyone, not just the parents. If you were paying at all, even a little bit of attention to the kids' sermon, it's a little bit of a spoiler for what we're about to talk about. Let me just say, I really enjoy doing little kids' messages like that. I also really enjoy doing sermons and giving sermons to adults, but sometimes my tone and my intonation is gonna get confused probably a little bit. So if I start talking to you like you're a child, please do not take that as a sign of disrespect. It's more just me forgetting where I was 3 minutes ago. But that was just a little bit of our warm-up. So here's what we are going today for the rest of the church. We are also gonna be talking about the story of the Magi. This story is something that, if we're being honest, if you've been with our church for a number of years, actually we have not gotten to it in any of our Advent series, and I think, unfortunately, that's kind of a common occurrence among churches, is the Magi story is a little bit confusing. It comes after the birth of Jesus, and so our Advent series tend to crescendo up to Jesus' birth, and then we just kind of skip past the rest of it and move right along. And the Magi story actually only appears in one of the Gospels. It only appears in the Gospel of Matthew. And so it just doesn't get nearly as much attention. So I personally have loved researching, reading, hearing, talking about this story because I am fascinated by it. And so what I would love to do with you for these next, it's going to be short, maybe just about 10, 15 minutes or so, is kind of walk you through a little bit of what have I learned? What have I been thinking about in terms of what the Magi story is all about? Where does it come from? What does it mean? Why does it even appear in our Bibles at all? I do think, I will say that the job that I'm going to try to do today, I'm also going to try to tie the Magi story into, if you remember, the sermon series that we've been going through in the fall called Seven Signs, talking about Jesus as the Messiah using the book of John. And then our Advent series, which is based on the theme of immeasurably more. My goal is to take all three of those things, Magi, Immeasurably More, Seven Signs, and somehow weave and tie them all together, which is not going to be an easy job, but to be honest, I think I'm up for it because I volunteered for it, so I kind of have to be up for it. All right, let me start with a little bit of context. So I mentioned this actually a little bit with the kids in the story, but it's good for all of us to realize we actually have a lot of misconceptions about the Magi. You ever realize that? We have a ton of ideas that maybe they're true and maybe they're not. They're just things that we have believed for literally thousands of years. So one of those misconceptions is that there were three of them. There could have been. There were three gifts. That's kind of where we derive this number three from. But we don't know that for sure. The Gospel of Matthew just says wise men from the east. And even thinking if there were indeed only three wise men, they were traveling most likely with caravans upon caravans of supplies, equipment, servants probably. And so there were certainly more than just three people there. So that's one misconception that we have. We also have this misconception sometimes. We refer to them as the three kings, right? Actually, we're going to be a little bit later listening to the song, We Three Kings, which is one of my favorite songs. We're going to play it anyways, but in our heads, we're just going to swap out the word kings because I can tell you with confidence that these guys were not kings. The Bible refers to them as magi, which is one of these words that we don't have a super clear definition for, but basically the magi refers to like a class of people in the eastern kingdoms east of Israel, so Persia, Babylon, Parthia. They're a class of people, essentially like a priestly class, but their whole job was to study nature, particularly the stars, and interpret signs for the present day. So they were to look for patterns and things in the stars and be able to make predictions about what was happening or what would happen based on what they were perceiving. The other misconception that we often have, as I mentioned with the kids, is that we have this picture that they arrived, you know, maybe slightly after the shepherds, like that there was a queue waiting outside the stall where Jesus was born, and all the shepherds go through and pay their respects, and then the wise men come in with all them. Realistically, we don't know exactly when the wise men arrived, but it was probably sometime we know for sure it was within the first 2 years of Jesus's life, because King Herod, following the visit of the Magi, actually has all the children in Bethlehem in the Judea area under 2 years old killed, which tells us Jesus was probably somewhere around 2 years old when the wise men came to visit. So they didn't show up on the night he was born. They showed up sometime after. There are lots and lots more things that we think could be true about the Magi. Church tradition has looked at the Magi with awe and wonder, rightfully so, for a really long time. But I'm not going to try to go into any of that today, because the reality is most of those questions come down to unanswerable questions. Like, exactly what were the Magi like? You know, where were they from? All these kinds of questions that we may never know the answer to. So instead, our goal for today, we're going to stick just to the biblical text. We're not going to try to bring in any other church traditions, any other writings, anything like that. We're just going to stick to the biblical text from the book of Matthew and say, what can we learn about the Magi? And the bigger question being, what is this story even for, right? Why is it even in the scripture at all? There's got to be a reason that Matthew includes this story and no one else does. So you guys, if you want to put up Matthew chapter 2, if you have your Bible with you, you want to follow along with me. Matthew chapter 2, we're going to go verses 1 to 12. I encourage you to follow along with me. Now, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem, saying, where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him. When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. And assembling all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. They told him, in Bethlehem of Judea. For so it is written by the prophet, and you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. For from you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. Then Herod summoned the wise men secretly and ascertained from them what time the star had appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem, saying, go and search diligently for the child. And when you have found him, bring me word, that I too may come and worship him. After listening to the king, they went on their way. And behold, the star where they had seen when it rose went before them until it came to rest over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. And going into the house, they saw the child with Mary his mother, and they fell down and worshipped him. Then, opening their treasures, they offered him gifts, gold and frankincense and myrrh. And being warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they departed to their own country by another way. So this story, if you just read it, it's a little weird, right? It's kind of strange. It doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense. There doesn't seem to be a ton of really rich truth and detail in it. So we have to ask ourselves a question. Well, why is it here? Well, what's it there for, right? So these wise men, they show up. They're again, remember, like I said, the Magi are class people. Their job is to study the stars, to study nature, and look for signs to interpret the present. I think that this is a fascinating thing, this story of the star, right? And I think it's fascinating for a couple of reasons. First, if you guys remember, all the way at the beginning of Advent, Brian Marcioni was here. He was preaching on, from the Gospel of Luke, he was preaching on the visit of the shepherds. And he talked about how the word gospel, euangelion, this Greek word that we use to talk about the announcement of a king, the arrival, the birth of a king, this great announcement, how Luke intentionally uses that language to set up a comparison between Jesus and Augustus, Caesar of Rome at the time, to say, well, when Augustus was born, this is what the Roman heralds would go and do. They would proclaim the gospel, the euangelion, that Augustus was king. And when Jesus was born, the same thing happens, but they go to shepherds, right? You guys remember this comparison that Brian is making? So Matthew here is also making a very interesting comparison that we often just skip right over. Did you guys know that in Roman legend, in Roman tradition, on the night Augustus was born, a comet appeared in the sky to mark his birth? A star, you might say, appeared in the sky to mark the birth of Augustus. This was common knowledge in the Roman Empire. Whether or not you believed it, whether or not it mattered to you at all, you knew this story. Everyone knew this story. Because Augustus made sure that everyone knew this story, because it was a sign of the God's favor. So I think, personally, reading this story as a first century reader of Matthew, and you read a star rose on the day Jesus was born to show that he was born, alarm bells are all going off in your head saying, wait a minute, I know that story. I know a star was appeared on the night a great king was born. I know that that's happening. And so I think Matthew is drawing us to that same point of comparison to say, look, you know this one story. Here's a better story. Here's a better star, a better king, a better birth, better good news. But as according to the scripture, did anyone recognize this sign that was being put out? Certainly not the Jews. We have no Jewish people coming to visit Jesus saying, we saw this great star. I'd be willing to bet that this star was pretty obvious, pretty public. Maybe not the giant, kind of the way you picture it, like totally dominating the landscape. But still, enough so that these wise men from the east noticed it, came and found Jesus. They were able to follow it. And so none of the Jews, none of the chief priests, none of the scribes, none of the religious leaders interpret this sign correctly. Only these men from the east do. I think that's a fascinating little note, that the Jews missed it. The religious leaders, the people who are supposed to get it, missed it. And these Gentiles, they're the ones that see it and understand it. I also think it'd be helpful to give a little quick background about Herod, kind of in who he is and where he comes from, because that helps us understand this story a little better too. Herod, the king, he's not even traditionally of the Jewish community. Did you guys know that? Herod is actually of a line of people called the Edomites, which are, they draw their descendants back to Esau. That's Jacob and Esau, you know, the sons of Isaac, Jacob, the father of Israel, whose name would become Israel. Esau, his older brother, not part of that lineage. And so Herod actually comes from this family that's kind of tangentially related to the family of the Israelites. And he's the one who gets the title King of the Jews. Well, and you might be wondering to yourself, well, why does he get it then? If he can't trace the royal line, if he has no birth claim to the throne, Herod is allowed to be called King of the Jews because Rome said he could. And I'm not even over-exaggerating or oversimplifying. That's what happened. Roman Empire, who moved into Jerusalem at this time, was ruling the kingdom from afar, said, Herod, you have a lot of money. You're well-liked in Rome. Go ahead, be King of the Jews. We don't care. You can have the title. It doesn't matter. And really, Rome was the king behind the king. Am I right? Like, Herod may have had the king title. He may have been the one ruling in the palace, but Rome had the power. So Herod, if you could think, put yourself in his mind, he knows he's not born to the kingship. He knows he has not inherited it. He's not part of the royal line. And he knows he's done nothing to deserve it, that his kingship is purely a royal decree coming from a foreign power. You can imagine that that would create a little bit of paranoia, a little bit of insecurity, a little bit of instability in his mind. So then, these guys from the east, part of this class that's well-respected, show up and say, hey, where is the one who's been born King of the Jews? He was freaking out. Understandably so. And I find it so interesting that Herod then goes to the chief priests and goes to the scribes and says, all right, so where is this king supposed to be born? And they come back to him immediately, right? And they say, Bethlehem. They're supposed to be born in Bethlehem. Well, Herod knows he's not born in Bethlehem, so there's no way he can kind of make this about himself. So we see Matthew gives us this little bit of commentary that Herod was told the wise men, go and find him so that I too may come and worship him. But if you take that, knowing the story of what happens later when he's going to kill all the children under the age of two, and take into account this kind of background that we've just talked about with the paranoia and the insecurity, this is not a good story for Herod, right? There's another really interesting thing I noticed about this. The wise men, we have this kind of idea that the wise men knew exactly what they were looking for, right? That they show up, they say, we're looking for the King of the Jews, right? Because the wise men probably didn't have the Old Testament memorized. They probably hadn't studied the Jewish scriptures in detail. They probably had no idea who they were looking for. Not a clue. They just knew someone, somewhere had been born that meant something. The one who has been born, the King of the Jews. It's fascinating to me that they go, they're not even looking for their own king. They're not Jews. They're not part of the Jewish community. They're not part of the Jewish kingdom. They're not practicing Jewish believers. And yet there is something so significant about this sign, something so significant about the search, that they were willing to cross nations. We don't know how long they traveled for. If they came from Babylon, that's like a couple months walk. that came from Persia, we're talking about 6 months or more, depending on where. Persia's a really big place. We don't know where they came from, but we know that they traveled all the way to find a foreign king because something was significant about this sign. And then when we get there, this is the part that we all know, we all love to read about, right? They get there and they worship Jesus and they bring in these gifts. They've got 3 gifts for him. It's where we get the idea of the 3 kings or the 3 wise men. But the gifts give us a little bit of a clue into who Jesus was going to be. Again, remembering, the wise men didn't know who Jesus was going to be. No idea. They hadn't memorized all their scriptures to know what Jesus' life was going to look like. But these gifts, I think, represent to us something that God was doing the whole time in this story. So gold's a very logical gift that you give to a king, right? It's pretty common. You could see that not just in Jewish literature, but that's very common in ancient Near East tradition just in general. You come to a king, you bring him a gift of gold. Kings like gold. They probably have a lot of it. I don't know why they need more, but you give the king gold. That's what you do. So this tells us, very obviously, I'm going to draw these comparisons out because it's helpful. They're giving Jesus gold. That tells us Jesus is going to be a king. Great, we can remember that. But it also tells us that Jesus' kingdom is going to be one that includes all peoples, because the wise men are not Jews. Jesus is called the king of the Jews, and yet here are some non-Jews bringing him gold and declaring him to be king. Jesus is going to be king, but his kingdom includes everyone. Frankincense is the other gift that they bring. It's not an uncommon gift to bring to a king, but more realistically, the more practical use of frankincense or just incense in general would be, this is a gift you bring to God. Incense is what you bring to the temple, and you offer it as an offering to God at the temple. You burn incense, and that is, God is pleased through the burning of incense. This is true in Old Testament literature, if you read it. It's also true in other Near East religions at the time. Incense is a gift for a god. So, the second gift teaches us, okay, Jesus is king, but Jesus is also God, right? I don't think these are accidents. Again, I don't believe in accidents in Scripture. The wise men brought these gifts to show Jesus as king, to show Jesus as God. They worship him, which is something you do for a king. It's also something you do for God. I think there are these double meanings in all of this. Which brings us to the last gift, myrrh. So myrrh actually, in Old Testament times, had 2 different meanings, and it probably means both of these things. It doesn't mean one or the other. It means it could be used for both. The first meaning of myrrh is it's one of sadness and mourning, right? We often, if you maybe have heard someone preach on the Magi story before, you've heard myrrh is a burial spice. It's something you put on a body as you bury them. And there is beauty in that, right? Jesus is going to die. We know that with hindsight. Jesus is the king and the God who is going to die and be buried. So how beautiful and precious is it that they bring him this myrrh, this burial spice, proclaiming for all those to see, hey, this is a king who's going to die. But myrrh was also used for joy and celebration, actually. The Old Testament tells us that the clothes of God smell like myrrh, right? When you enter the temple of God, and you're around him and in his presence smells like myrrh. As the psalmist writes, your clothes smell of myrrh and it brings me joy. It brings me great happiness. So the smell of myrrh is one of those smells that's supposed to elicit excitement. It's supposed to elicit joy in one of us. You ever think of those smells in your life that just, they make you happy just by smelling them? You know, maybe it's a Christmas tree like this for me. Maybe it's freshly baked cookies. Maybe it's your grandma's house. I don't know what it is. But we all have those smells that you breathe it in and it just, you cannot help but smile. Myrrh is one of those things in the Old Testament. So when they bring Jesus myrrh, it's the refreshing, joyful, delightful presence of God. So we put these 3 gifts together. And the wise men, with no background, with no knowledge in any of this, offer Jesus proof of his kingship, his godship, and his death, but his celebration of his death. that his suffering will end up being a joyful suffering. So how does this fit into the seven signs, like I said? So John, we talked about, the seven signs of John are pointing to Jesus as Messiah. Matthew is also trying to make that same point here, but it's a little bit different, right? The seven signs in John are miracle stories, healing, or deliverance, something like that. This isn't a miracle story in the same exact way, but really where I see the connection here is that every time John in his gospel points out one of these signs of Jesus, he says, this was done to reveal the glory of God, or Jesus' glory, to demonstrate his glory. You guys see how glory is found in this story, right? A baby, a lowly baby being worshipped by three men from far away who know nothing about him. Have you ever been in a room with someone or with a group of people and you just know, without anyone having to say anything, you know who's in charge, right? Like, you know who the authority is. You walk in and it's, oh, this person's here. We know who the boss is. When the wise men walked into the room where Jesus was, everyone knew who the boss was, and it was the child. It was the baby. As that's a pretty good sign of Jesus' glory to me, is when you're in his presence, you cannot help but worship him. But how does this fit into our theme of immeasurably more, right? That's been our Advent theme, is that God is doing immeasurably more. Jesus is immeasurably more. Well, I think the Magi story tells us here is it takes whatever little boxes that we've placed our hope in, we've placed our joy in, and it blows it all up, right? Our hope in the king to deliver Israel, blown up, because here's these non-Jews who are coming to worship the king for everyone. Our hope in peace on earth blown up because Jesus, the baby, is the one who has come to bring peace. And I think by setting up this comparison too between Jesus and Augustus, we see Jesus is a hope for a new king with a new kingdom that we could never have even imagined. Immeasurably more. So what do we do about it? I think the only logical response is to worship. Now, we kind of do this every week. If you've been in our church for a little while, we like to worship in response to our messages. Kelly, you can come on up. We tend to sing a song, or maybe we have some kind of prompt or reflection. And that's good. We should always be worshiping. But I think if we read the story of the Magi, these three guys with no context who show up to see a child, and the only thing they can do is fall down and worship him and offer him gifts that they brought. Well, to me that says, well, that's how we should respond too, right? So I'm going to invite you guys to stand. I want you to stand with me as we worship. But here's what we're going to do. We're going to sing. I mentioned earlier, we're going to sing the song, We Three Kings. And again, in your head knowing they're not kings, but that's okay. The song's beautiful anyways. And I want you to, whether if you're familiar with the song, great, by all means, sing along. If you're not, there are a lot of words. My encouragement would be to just reflect and meditate on the words that we are going to be singing. They'll be up here on the screen if you need to follow along. But there's something beautiful in this song. There's something beautiful about the way that the wise men come to Jesus, not knowing anything. They didn't have to have a Bible degree, right? They didn't have to have all the answers. They didn't have to understand who they were going to visit and why. They saw a sign, they knew what it meant, and they were obedient. And when they found Jesus himself, they worshiped him. That's the only thing they could have done. And that's the only thing that we can do. Would you join with me? And I'm going to pray, and then we're going to worship. Jesus, thank you. And thank you that when we walk into the room, we know who the boss is. God, thank you for your authority. Thank you for your leadership. Thank you for being the king and the God of all and everything and everyone. But also thank you for coming in the way that you did, coming in humility, coming in simplicity, coming in a way that prioritized us rather than prioritizing yourself, coming in a way that honored us rather than honoring yourself. So Jesus, with all of my friends here this morning, I just say we want to turn that honor back towards you. We want to worship you for the king you are, for the God you are, the suffering God who brings us great joy.